OTB.
Don't shoot.
Oh, he dinked it. Oh!
It's a goal!
It's a goal!
The 6-1.
What a ball!
Rafinha hit. Oh, 15 seconds left.
That is amazing.
OTB live commentary. Never miss the action right here on OTB Sports Radio. Keep up to date with the latest scores on the OTB Sports app. The OTB Sports app. Live score updates straight to your phone. The OTB Podcast Network.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
And you're welcome to the Sunday Paper Review on Off the Ball. I'm John Duggan, sitting in for Joe Molloy. Delighted to be joined by the former Leinster Connacht and Ireland hooker and rugby coach Bernard Jackman and the presenter of Off the Bench and sports writer Cliona Foley. Bernard and Cliona, how are we all today?
Really good, thank you. Great to be on.
Yeah, no, looking forward to this. As always, Sunday Paper Review, great to have it. And we'll just go through the front and the back pages, the front pages of the sporting sections of the broadsheets. The wait is over. After 38 years, Scotland finally beat England at Twickenham. Great to see in the Six Nations ahead of Ireland and Wales today. Adam Wynne-Jones punched in training by teammate. This is in the Sunday Times. The Wales captain, Adam Wynne-Jones, was punched in training by his teammate, Jake Ball, being left with a black eye before his side's Six Nations opener against Ireland at the Principality Stadium today. Also on the front page of the Sunday Times, Duffy has found it hard to settle, says Lennon. So he's found it difficult to settle, says Celtic manager Neil Lennon. He's up here on his own. Life away from the training ground is difficult for them all, especially the guys who are up here on their own. He would be the first to admit he hasn't been as good as he can be, and he'll be massively disappointed with that because of the way he feels about the club. He'd been very self-analytical to his detriment. He's been very hard on himself, getting in a chorus of criticism as well from all and sundry. When you go home to an empty house, it can be difficult to deal with the times. We're giving him all the support we can get. So this is the Sunday Times front page. Sunday Independent. Doris cloud over Ireland's big kickoff about Caelan Doris. Ireland number 8, Caelan Doris, written by Brendan Fanning there, to travel to Birmingham this week to see a neurologist for ongoing issues around concussion, it is understood. Everton delivers sucker punch to United's title hopes. That is on the front page of the Sunday Independent after that 3-3 draw in the Premier League last night. The back of the Sunday World, Pep, you're a loser. City boss furious with Klopp ahead of the showdown between Manchester City and Liverpool at Anfield today in the Premier League. Live on News Talk from 4:30 with Nathan Murphy and Damian Delaney calling the shots. Pep Guardiola's continued his war of words with Jurgen Klopp by accusing the Liverpool manager of playing a blame game to explain his side's alarming slump in form. And United knocked off their perch. Ole's boys denied top spot in the Premier League by Dom's last gasp Everton goal. That's Dominic Calvert-Lewin. That's the Sunday World. The back of the Sun, wine club, once again, Pep Guardiola. Excuses the worst thing. Pep Guardiola's told Jurgen Klopp to shut up and stop making excuses for Liverpool's crumbling title defence. Ole Dom for in Fergie time. Dominic Calvert-Lewin, so old Dom, scoring the equaliser in the 3-3 draw. Come and have a go. This is about the Dublin Racing Festival, the Gold Cup at Leopardstown today. Willie Mullins and Ken Boy. I'll burn all bridges. Tadhg Byrne facing former Welsh colleagues. And Wayne Pivac in the Six Nations match today, Ireland and Wales. Back in the mirror, shut up Klopp. Once again, Guardiola hits back at Jibe. You're making excuses, Jurgen. And blew it big time, United. Man United 3, Everton 3. And Tadhg and Ireland target Byrne supremacy. So Tadhg Byrne the focus, given a selection in the second row. At the back of the people, no excuse. Pep not buying Klopp's reasons for Klopp's lump as war of words erupts. And Calvert, ruin. Late equaliser stops United drawing level with City at Premier Summit. Back of the people. The Sunday Mail, the Irish Daily Mail on Sunday, all on the line. Ireland and Wales fight for futures in Cardiff. Cauldron by Rory Keane. An injury time agony for Ole. Man United 3, Everton 3. And Chelsea star, social media profits from racism. Antonio Rudiger is the latest high-profile Premier League star to reveal he suffered immense racist abuse on social media, prompting Chelsea to launch an investigation which would result in police action. It could result in that and see some of their fans banned from their own club. And a profile as well in the Sunday Business Post on Tom Brady, head of the Super Bowl later tonight, the Kansas City Chiefs against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. A man for all seasons, Emmett Ryan, doing a piece on Tom Brady, which we'll get to over the next hour with Cliona. And Bernard, I think we probably should start, Bernard, with that kind of breaking news story in the front of the Sunday Times. Adam Wynne-Jones punched in training by his teammate. Does this happen much and we just don't hear about it in rugby?
It probably happens less and less. I think certainly 10 years ago, it was often a really good gauge that you're ready for for the upcoming game, if there was that intensity at training that sometimes boiled over. And, you know, there's definitely been massive push, particularly with the concussion issues, to knock it out of the game. And I'd imagine that's part of the reason Jake Ball isn't involved today. Jake Ball is the guy who's rumored to have been in the punch up with Adam Wynne Jones after a mauling session. Jake Ball was an amateur boxer in Australia, so by all accounts, he's quite good with his fists, and he landed a couple of good punches. And often, to be honest, that's probably why it's unusual, in that sometimes it's usually just a bit of push and shoving, over exuberance, and it doesn't really come to actual boxes thrown. But in this case, by all accounts, there has been, and Jake Ball isn't on the bench, which is a boost for Ireland, because coming off the bench, a ball carrier like him would be far more impactful than the guy they have gone with, a guy called Will Rowlands, who's more of a set-piece player. But for me, it's a little bit of a sign that there's tetchiness, there's unease in the Welsh camp. And, you know, given the experience they've gone for, experienced players can handle that pressure, or tend to handle that pressure a little bit better. So if there is going to be a spike in Wales' performances, which have been really poor in 2020, just 3 wins out of 10, twice against Italy and once against Georgia. So on form, you couldn't fancy Wales, but giving the experience they have and the quality they have with multiple British and Irish Lions, multiple Grand Slam winners, potentially there's going to be an uplift, and that's a little bit worrying from an Irish point of view.
Did you get involved in any dust-ups in your career, Bernard? Do you want to talk about?
I was an absolute Saint Bernard. I was called. Now, look, in the fairness, I
Better Valley beats them all.
I try to avoid them if I could, but look, it's about playing on the edge and training on the edge, and yeah, the odd time it does flip over or blow over. But the problem is when you have this team picked, and it's the first against seconds on a test week or a big Highland Cup week. And it's mauling where, you know, effectively, if you're defending a maul, it's far easier to be illegal and cheat than it is to stay within the rules and be effective. So without a match referee, without a penalty system, without yellow cards, people do cheat. And the starting team get frustrated with that. So it can boil over. But as I said, it's rare that it becomes a case where someone gets a black eye. And someone like Adam Wynne Jones, obviously, you know, he wouldn't be used to being physically attacked in training. So, look, some people would say, oh, it's a sign the Welsh are fighting. And, you know, as I said, I would be more worried about, can they, you know, is that a sign that they're really on edge and are going to pull something out of the fire tonight, this afternoon?
Just before we get to the rugby articles in the papers themselves, with Josh Adams as well going offside with that COVID issue, does this suggest to you, Bernard, that there's a bit of lax, that they're... there's a bit of tension and trouble in that camp?
Look, I think it was always going to be difficult for whoever came in after Warren Gatland. And you weren't just losing Warren Gatland. The team manager followed Warren Gatland to the Lions. He'd been involved for about 15 years, a really good influence on the squad. You had Rob McBride, Rob Howley, Sean Edwards, all moving on at the same time. And it's difficult when, particularly in Wales, where it's a bit of a goldfish bowl, when they bring in a coach from within Wales. So Wayne Pivac had been successful with the Scarlets. It straight away leads the players in the other three regions to believe there's going to be a bias towards the Scarlets players. And we have seen a strong Scarlets selection, and even the second choice scrum half for the Scarlets is in ahead of a guy called Rhys Webb, who's playing really well. So things aren't rosy there. But, you know, the Josh Adams thing was very unfortunate for Pivac. I mean, when you're under pressure and a player makes a stupid mistake like that, it just really can frustrate you. You know, he's had a couple of injuries. Liam Williams is suspended from a Pro 14 game. So things aren't great for them. But as I said, I would be worried about the ability of likes of Dan Bigger, Ken Owens, Toby Faletau to circle the wagons and put in a performance and get... if they beat Ireland today, they're up and running again, you know? So it's a fickle game, and it doesn't look like they're in great shape, but I'd rather make that decision around their form at 5 o'clock this afternoon.
Aclina, where is the best rugby writing?
Well, it varies really, I suppose. The Sunday Times, the Sunday Indoor are both good today. Tadhg Byrne, actually, by coincidence, obviously played for Pivac in Scarlet. So he was the one, he's kind of the feature article in a lot of the papers today, talking about that. And also Ironically as well, he reveals that he was once a crash test dummy or whatever, a body double for Paul O'Connell back in his early days when he was a youngster, and used to kind of double up for photo shoots and that he was once hauled in to do a photo shoot and kind of double up for Paul O'Connell in a sponsored gig. So I thought that was funny, and it just shows, because obviously there's going to be so much concentration on the line out today, but in fact it's because there's been so much focus on that during the week, I think it isn't something that's gone into in big detail today. Neil Francis talks about Josh van der Fleer. He's looking for him to be a bit more aggressive and be less nice, basically. He's saying he needs to bite the hind legs off the Welsh today. So that's one worth reading as well. But I thought Brendan Fanning's piece in Sunday Indo on Tadhg Byrne, I thought was the nicest piece, just because the way he just kind of described it. He says, Paul O'Connell was Mr. Hollywood. He'd rock up from his trailer on the studio lot. Byrne, who was in the Leinster Academy, was the stand-in, hungry for a few bob extra. O'Connell was the star. And now, you know, it's his chance really to shine today in a big way.
And a lot of reaction, I'm sure, Bernard, as well, to Scotland England yesterday.
Yeah, there was. Just to finish on Tadhg Byrne, I mean, there's a couple of different pieces that show how it's not a straightforward upward curve to be successful. So Tadhg Byrne, you know, he was let go by Leinster. Rachel Blackmore, you know, was struggling as an amateur, and now she's a top professional jockey. Tom Brady, obviously, being very low down the ranking in the draft. So just for people maybe whose careers aren't going the way they feel, perseverance and resilience is really important. But on Tadhg Byrne, I remember at a Pro 14 launch, he just won Player of the Year, I think, for Scarlets, and I was slagging Leo Cullen for letting him go in front of Tadhg Byrne, and we're having a bit of crack for not keeping him. And then Tadhg Byrne reminded me that I didn't pick him for a scholarship in DCU, which would be a lot easier to win than a Leinster contract. So, I'm guilty myself in terms of ignoring his talents. But, great story for him. And, England-Scotland, I mean, a phenomenal result for Scotland. They backed Gregor Townsend despite a poor World Cup. And, you know, he's changed. He's actually changed how they play, and he's gone to a more boring, pragmatic style. But I think there's not a Scot fan in the world who will be critical of that this morning, having watched an unbelievably spirited and well-deserved win away in Twickenham.
But I thought they were anything but boring yesterday, Bernard. I mean, just the way they went at England, the way they moved them around. I mean, obviously, Finn Russell would give you a heart attack every time you were managing him, but I thought they were extraordinary yesterday in that they tried to vary it a lot.
Yeah, no, they did. In fairness, there was variety to their game, but I mean, they scored 11, they conceded 6. I mean, that's unheard of for the way that Gregor Townsend model in Glasgow was, or how he started. It is definitely not a boring style of game, but it's very defense in place first, your scrum set piece in place second, and then after that, if we have an opportunity to attack, we'd attack. And they have the players to do it. I mean, Redpath, you know, I don't know if you know this, Brian Redpath's son, Cameron, had played English under 20s. Gregor made a big push, and he was probably one of the stars of the game. It's a great moment. It's great for Scotland. They've had a really tough time at international level, and you'd have to imagine now that they'll build on this.
And what I thought was brilliant about Redpath, John, was that, you know, if you look at him physically, he's not the prototype, you know, the player that, you know, we all think of as rugby now. Like he looked like a schoolboy in some ways physically in the middle of them yesterday. But he had the feet and he had the hands. And, you know, Stuart Barnes has a lovely line about, you know, I mean, he talks about virtuoso Finn Russell. I mean, they gave him, I think he Stephen Jones gave him 9 out of 10, but my God, some of his decisions, including the trip and getting the bin, you would wonder, I wouldn't give him 9 out of 10. But when he's brilliant, he's brilliant. But what Stuart Barnes says actually is, I mean, and they all talked about the clear lack of English fitness and some players not obviously getting premiership time. But he says, at Twickenham, the human touch denied the robots. Even Englishmen should celebrate such a cheering fact. Because it was, I just thought there was loads of flair in Scotland yesterday. And also just, they didn't lie down, you know, they just took England on. Even before you could see in the warm-up, like at the huddles, they were just, you could see they were really, really up for it.
Yeah, Oliver Brown, if this can be such a phenomenon as an 11-6 trouncing, then here it was. On Finn Russell, he was not even on speaking terms of Gregor Townsend, convincing the coach's drill sergeant methods were dampening his attacking flair. With his performance, he again contrived to be both majestic and maddening.
It's so true, isn't it? I mean, he's extraordinary. And you saw Townsend at one stage, I think just before halftime, when he got the card, and Townsend's head just went down in the stands. And then, you know, and even the drop kick at the end, and you're going, oh my God, no, don't do that. Some of the decision making was dodgy in the extreme, but when you have, you know, such flair as well, and Hogg, I thought, was immense yesterday. It was just a brilliant performance. And, you know, you'd look at, I was looking at Stephen Jones's ratings of England. I was surprised nobody got less than a 5, which was a bit of a surprise for me, because I thought they were dreadful yesterday.
Undercooked, yeah. Bernard, as well.
Yeah, and I don't want to make excuses for them, but certainly the fact that Saracens are in the championship, you know, Farrell, Billy Bunipola was the only one who played a game. He played a match against Ealing, but he really looked off the pace, and all the Saracens players were off the pace. And in fairness, England have said they're going to try and evolve their game and attack a little bit more, but they were clueless in attack. I mean, when they had to chase the game in the last 20 minutes, they had no ideas. And I know that they've changed their attack coach. Scott Weismantle has gone back to Australia. The skills coach didn't come back because of COVID. But, I mean, you'd wonder, has Eddie Jones's, and it's, look, he's been very successful, but there was such a lack of energy and such a lack of a plan. And I know he came out afterwards and said, oh, it's on me, but that's his go-to. And we don't hear very often because they win a lot of games because of their sheer power. But will that give a boost to France, who have to go to Twickenham? You know, we played them the last day. And is there vulnerabilities there that we hadn't seen before, that now everyone will start to exploit? A little bit like us after 2018, where teams worked us out. And is he going to be able to build a plan B quick enough?
The RFU statement on the front page of the Sunday Independent Sport in this Brendan Fanning article, Caelan Doris has flagged some symptoms that could be associated with concussion. He's returned to Leinster to allow his symptoms to be appropriately assessed and investigated. Bernard, could this mean that Caelan Doris could be out for longer than we would have maybe thought?
Yeah, just he's been sent to see a neurologist in Birmingham, and I've sent players there through my time in the Dragons, and by all accounts he's the best in this area, and huge experience across contact sports. So that's a great sign that the RFU are sending him over to see one of the world's best neurologists. I would imagine he may not play in this competition, or certainly won't play in the next few weeks. It's generally when you've tried other areas of rehab that you take that next step. So, and look, the most important thing is that he's well looked after and proper medical care. And with the RFU, that's not going to be an issue. But it's amazing. I think he's only got 7 caps. He's actually such an important player for Ireland. He was so important for us this week. He's going to be so important for us in the Six Nations because of his ability. And hopefully he just, it's something that he gets sorted out now, no matter how long we have to give him to rest, and it doesn't become an issue for him in the long term.
You Farrelly wrote a piece about the match today that you enjoyed, Cliona.
Yeah, and I mean, actually, you know, Doris is such an exciting player, and he has youth on his side, and we are all looking for, you know, a new young Ireland team to come through. And Hugh Farrelly is looking ahead to, if you like, he has come back to this before in the Mail on Sunday, but he's come back to a theme of his, which is that, you know, where is the bravery in the selection, if you like. So, you know, he's looking at him and saying, you know, where are we going with the team? Where's the vision for it? How many of this starting 15, that's today's team, with any degree of confidence, will be frontline options at the next World Cup once we factor in age, durability and dependable form? And he stresses, he says, look, no matter how their careers conclude, the surnames of Sexton, Murray, Earls, Healy, O'Mahony and Standard will be remembered for their distinguished contribution to the national cause. And no one is saying categorically they won't have a role to play in France in 2023, but logic decrees that other avenues need to be explored. And this is his theme is really, you know, and if we look at the, I suppose, particularly if you look at the French, you know, and how brave they have been in their selections over the last two, you know, last season and again now, he's saying, imagine if today's team had Craig Casey, Ross Byrne at 10, Harry on the bench, Tadhg Byrne at number 6, Ryan Baird in the second row, Gavin Coombs, and he mentions Doris was obviously injured. You know, he said, just he feels that, you know, we're still being too conservative with our selection, and that after the World Cup it was time to maybe start to bring in younger players earlier. So it's a good piece. I think rugby people will be really interested in, because he never holds back on his views, and his views are always fairly well balanced. And he's also pointing out, you know, he has question marks. He's saying James Lowe's engaging style of play and personality, but he said he hasn't had much game time this season, and he questioned his inclusion ahead of Jordan Larmour today.
And we also have a piece about Moss Finn.
Yeah, I like this piece in the Mail on Sunday today. I think it's with Mark Gallagher, isn't it? It's really nice. Moss, the former Ireland wing, and obviously a big Munster man as well. And it's just a really nice sort of just a really nice piece, I think, because Finn he's not only talking about you know just how things were in what is nearly 40 years ago, I suppose, at this stage, but he's also talking about the style of rugby, you know, and he's very strong, and he's saying, you know, he meets people now and they all say the game is very boring because it's so much you know, there's so much emphasis on grunt and none on flair, and there's no spontaneity anymore. Well, I think yesterday I would say contradicted that, and that's why it's so brilliant. But you know, he talks about those great, great Welsh players. A lot of us grew up watching, like Barry John and Gareth Edwards and JPR. And he's saying he'd love to see Craig Casey. You know, and again, you know, he says he reminds me of Jacques Vrew, who was only about 5'4". You know, and he's saying, you know, there are flair players out there, and he'd like to probably, I think his feeling is that the game again has gone just a little bit too based on grunt and set pieces.
It was just interesting talking about the past there. Neil Francis in this article about Josh van der Fleer speaking about going to France for the Grand Slam game in 1982, and this is the quote. Yeah. In the lead up to the 82 match in Paris, Willie Duggan broke a curfew before the game, but it was almost obligatory that you did so in those days. Some Parisian taxi driver broke Willie's arm with his head, and Ireland's toughest hombre did not play in the big game. That series, though, was played 8 years ago. This is about 2012 in the Welsh back row, when they were dominant in the Lions tour of Australia. In the pro game, that's a long time, have the Welsh, a bit like the French, brought back and also kept on some of their hard-nosed, experienced core. Tipperich, 31 years of age, Lydia, 33, Faletau, 30, and Jones, 35, have got 384 caps between them. That's 36 more than the entire Ireland pack. Just how significant will that experience be today? Bernard, how are you assessing what's going to happen in Cardiff at 3 o'clock on this great afternoon?
Look, I think that the challenge for us will be to get some ball. I think our back line should be able to expose George North, who's back in form, but on the wing. I mean, Gatland tried to convert him to a 13 without great success. He's definitely a better winger. Hallam Amos is in now because of Josh Adams' mishap. And, you know, defensively, I coach Hallam. Defensively, he's a little bit prone to lacks of concentration and some errors. And Lewis Rees-Sammet, that lost their winger, is an absolute flyer with ball in hand, but defensively he's not the best, and you would fancy James Lowe to be able to physically dominate him. So I think we have their number in the outside backs. The challenge for us is that grisly, gnarly pack that they've picked is to be able to get some go forward, and there's probably a little bit of worry about the number of ball carriers in our pack. I think with Doris being out, we're very reliant on Porter and James Ryan. Keane Healy's not carrying as much as he used to. Van der Fleer is more of a link man. So that's probably the area of concern. And we had a very good last performance against Scotland when the team played with a lot of emotion. There was a bit of a, you know, circle of wagons, the media are against us, we're being questioned. And we're probably going to have to go to the emotional level of that again to get a good start. Now, the Welsh, Gatland always said the Welsh were 10 points better in the Principality Stadium. No crowd today. You'll have to fancy that will negate that. I mean, definitely helped Scotland yesterday. I think we'll win, but I don't know if we'll be dominant.
Okay, that's the Six Nations rugby analysis. What have you got elsewhere, Cliona? Going to give some soccer stories?
Yeah, well, obviously the big game today is
taking City.
A lot of... there are a lot of interest. At the moment, to me, it just feels like it's wall-to-wall soccer at the moment. And, you know, sometimes it's hard to get your head around it because there's so much hype about every single game. But I did like, there's a piece by James Ducker in the Sunday Independent, and it's just about how Man City have turned their season around. And he kind of looks at it under, you know, three or four headings. And particularly, he's very strong on Ruben Diaz's job and the job that he's doing. So I just thought that's a really interesting piece. He talks about João Cancelo as well. He was saying only Jack Grealish, Bruno Fernandes and De Bruyne have created more chances from open play or played more passes into the penalty area this year than Cancelo. So I thought that's a good piece because it just looks about how he's tweaked the midfield. You know, there's a few key players and how they, you know, how they're contenders now as well.
Yeah, and, like, Yeah, it's
go ahead, sorry.
Go on.
No, there's just a few pieces today then obviously as well, but not on on today's game, but Gareth Bale and Gareth Bale's form and, you know, what he's at and what they're going to do with him is a big, it comes up everywhere. Depending on where you read it, one paper has him on 200,000 a week, John. Somebody else has him on 600,000 a week. So there's a big gap between 200,000 and 600,000, isn't there?
He'll settle for four.
What's 200,000 and 600,000 between friends? Yeah, this is in the Sunday Times. Jonathan Norcroft, watching him in one of his fleeting cameos for Spurs, going through the motions, staying away from contact, jogging across Premier League pitches where he used to surge, feels like watching Sandy Lyle shoot another 85 of the Masters or Venus Williams go out in another Grand Slam first round. I think the writing's on the wall for Gareth Bale at Spurs. And also Sam Wallace writing about this in the Sunday Independent. He participated cheerfully enough in the exercises. This is the other night against Chelsea when he wasn't brought on. Yeah. The consensus is his race is run, his legs no longer capable of the great turbo touchline sprints, that he no longer cares. Although even now that still feels hard to rationalise, the golf obsession, the occasional moments of immaturity can disguise the fact that the great Bale years did not happen by accident.
Yeah, and the Norcroft piece as well, Norcroft as well writing about him, I think is more sympathetic piece as well, and I think one of the problems for professional footballers, isn't it, is that if you have such if there's such a wage packet on your back and you can't click, you know, and we see it with Liverpool at the moment with some of their players as well, you know, then everything about you is, you know, being parsed and analysed, every tiny gesture in the warm-up, everything, do you know what I mean? So, like, while we may be envious of their lifestyles and the pay packet, sometimes I think, you know, would you want every single thing that you do to be so analysed? And, you know, I think Bale is a classic example of that.
Shane Duffy, Paul Rowan's written a piece in the Sunday Times, how Duffy's Celtic dream turned into a nightmare. Defenders' loss of confidence after failing to adapt to a new style of play is a worry for Kenny and Ireland. Look, this has been well documented, both in print and on our channels over the last few months. It's a tough one for Shane. It's hard to kind of get yourself out of that rut, isn't it, Bernard?
Yeah, for sure. And particularly if you're, you know, a defender who makes some high-profile mistakes or a goalkeeper, you know, who lets some soft goals in, it can just build that pressure and that sense of frustration. And I think reading the article, you know, he's up in Glasgow on his own. His family are down south. And if you aren't playing to form, going home in the evening, you know, there's a lot of pressure. It seems to be, you know, a lot of social media talk about him, and not every player is capable of just shutting that out. And obviously that criticism, that pressure is starting to get to him, and he's got no release valve. He's going back to his hotel or his flat at night, and he's used to having a family around him. And certainly I noticed that in France, you know, when we brought players over from the Pacific Islands, you know, where family is a huge thing, it took them a long time to settle. They really missed that, and it affects their sport. And likewise, I've had players where, you know, say the last year of their contract, they maybe send a family back home ahead of them to get into school and get set up, and it just completely affects their normal routine. So I definitely feel that, you know, it's horrible that he's having a dip in form at a time when he's potentially, you know, a little bit isolated and out of his normal bubble, to use that word, but his normal support structure, which for a lot of players is absolutely key to keeping them grounded when they're going really well, but also to lift them back up and give them a sense of normality when things are tough.
There's a really nice piece, John, today by Paul Rowan, actually, on Gavin Bazunu, the young Irish goalkeeper, the under 21 goalkeeper, on how he got signed in Man City and his relationship with them. Obviously, he's on loan at the moment, I think, isn't it, to Rochdale. But I was really interested, you know, just about that thing about Bernard saying about, you know, how important your background is, your family is, you know, because it is a lonely lifestyle for a lot of professional athletes. And particularly, I think, you know, in football, when a manager can change and suddenly you're out of favour and you have to find your way in. But it's a very interesting read, I think, well worth a read, just to see how he's been treated, how he was brought into the first team, how Pep has, he, you know, he's met Pep a few times, and now that he's in Rochdale, obviously he's got Brian Barry Murphy, so, you know, he's got an Irish boss who obviously knows the scene at home. But actually, what's really interesting, and it's a credit to them, that when he signed for City, he was in October 2018, he was studying for his leaving, with the help of Shamrock Rovers, a scholarship at Ashfield College, which is a private school in Dundrum, and that offered him some flexibility about his studying and training, right? So he ended up going to Man City, but he used to return on a weekly basis and did his leaving and managed, he said, to pass his weakest subject was in Irish. And I'd say all that kind of stuff, you know, that kind of support system, you know, that's a huge help to young players and kind of gives them, I think, the, you know, just the personal strength, if you like, to deal with, you know, what are always very precarious careers.
Yeah, it's really impressive, Cliona, in that article as well, how Man City haven't just sent him off to Rochdale on loan. Yeah. There's constant feedback. They're still mentoring. He's kind of feels he's still part of their progression. And the way Rochdale play is similar to how Man City play. So, I mean, I don't think every club are as good at looking after their young talent as Man City seem to be in that article, through education, but also through looking at, I said, keeping an eye on him while he's on loan somewhere else.
Yeah, the quote is, the possibility of an intense rivalry for the Ireland jersey between Bazunu and the Liverpool goalkeeper, Creevan Kelleher, who's 3 years older and has played in the Champions League and Premier League this season, is a source of optimism for Ireland supporters. It's a pity we didn't have that competition for the rest of them, Darren Ranoff as well, for the rest of the places in the Irish team. We can't score a goal to save our lives at the moment. Graeme Souness was also writing in the Sunday Times about the game we're doing on Off the Ball later. Liverpool and Man City. One stat that does interest me this season confirms that home advantage is no longer a factor in this COVID era of football without fans. 37% home win percentage versus 41% away.
Yeah, and it'll be really interesting to see, John, whether, you know, this happens with Six Nations as well, which, you know, from the start yesterday into Twickenham, it's really interesting, you know, not to have that buzz, that home buzz, which is so important in Six Nations. And the other piece I like today as well, and let's hope it doesn't crop up yet again this afternoon, but Alison Rudd has a very good piece on VAR in the Sunday Times. And she says, VAR has turned us into trigonometry boars, but is it not too late to change how it works? And she's, you know, she says the offside rule is supposed to deter goal hangers, not trigonometry boars. And, you know, that notion that, like, players will be thinking about their armpit and their toes, you know, going across the line. Like, you can't put the genie back in the bottle, she's saying. You know, it's here. No matter how unpopular it is, it's here. But it's how you start to use it, because it's cropping up, obviously, all over the place and has been in the news yet again this week.
And with Socek last night as well for West Ham getting sent off, and Mike Dean going over to the monitor. And unfortunately,
and the reversal of it,
but that's all we're talking about, and it's boring, you know. I'd rather be talking about the game itself today, Liverpool City, who's going to win, what are the going to be the difference in winning and losing. Like Roy Curtis writing in the Sunday World about it today, about Liverpool's decline under Klopp. Now, maybe that's a temporary decline, but he writes they've taken 57 points from 31 games since this last summer's restart, compared with 88 from the 31 before coronavirus stopped last season in mid-sentence. Roberto Firmino has endured a lengthy retreat toward mediocrity. Trent Alexander-Arnold has hit a speed bump. Without Henderson and Fabinho by his side, Thiago has been unable to deliver the expected creative jolt. The three Premier League muggings in a grim month have been inflicted not by muscular superpowers, but by the small-town Brighton and Burnley and by Southampton team, who lost last week leaking 9 at Old Trafford. Too often Liverpool look confounded, a team grasping futility for solutions to a crossword where the clues are in a foreign tongue.
It's a good piece, actually, isn't it? A very good piece, all right. And Jonathan Norcroft has a great line. He quotes that the Klopp line at the moment, the one after Brighton, when he says, "We would destroy with our backside what we build with our hands," which he says is a wonderful translation of some German phrase. But that does seem to be the case at the moment. So today is a huge game, obviously, and there's going to be massive, massive Irish interest in it. There always is when particularly with Liverpool involved in anything.
And it is live and off the ball on News Talk with Nathan Murphy and Damien Delaney, exclusive commentary. Bernard, where would you like to go next?
I really enjoyed Dermot Crowe in the Independent, his interview with Sean Flood. I jumped on the bandwagon 96 for Wexford.
Why?
Where we live, we're kind of on the Wicklow-Carlow border, but not far from Wexford. And I had a couple of friends from Wexford, and so it was good fun following him. But just, he seems like such a character, and he just tells a couple of really fun, really nice stories about Liam Griffin was always trying to get him to give up cigarettes, and they were in a clubhouse the year after the All-Ireland, and he stood up, and there's a big crowd there. He called for attention, and he said, "Liam Griffin is spending years trying to get me to give up the cigarettes. I'm now going to make a statement here and now. I'm going to get Liam Griffin to last my very last cigarette." Everyone gathered around. He gave Liam the lighter and everything. And it was one of those lighters that gave you a shock, you know, and that was a little cranky. He played on him. He just speaks again. I mean, in a day before social media, and we spoke about Duffy getting abuse about his form. His father won three All-Irelands with Wexford, Tim Flood. And he remembers his father died in 2014, but he remembers walking into Croke Park to hurl, and some old fella there from Wexford, he called me over and said, "Young Flood, best of luck now today, but I'll tell you one thing. You'll never be as good a man as your father." I was on the way in. I wouldn't mind if I was on the way out. So hard to please some fans in Wexford. And then just, he's big into music, big into farming. He just seemed to have a really good balance. But, you know, telling a story about his father, he went to buy his father a bike when he was 80 so he could cycle out, up the hills looking after sheep. And what else did he say? Oh, yeah, Liam Griffin had spoken to Sean Flood for a long time about his diet. When good nutrition were becoming parts of the county team's preparation, but he wasn't going to get involved in that. He said, "Hurling was what I liked to be doing. I wanted to be a hurler, and that didn't mean I wanted to be a runner." And again, just the last part, and Kleena, I'll give you a chance here if there's something I missed, but I mean, his view on the fouling off the ball, and I don't think Congress are going to take this on board, but he basically said, this hitting him in the back when the hurl was down, when the play was down the far end of the field, is jarring him out the whole time. I personally believe if a fella's allowed to do that to you, should be allowed to turn and pull across him. This is what I think should happen. So I can't see that being brought in. But look, it just seems like a free spirit. Was only a small guy in physical stature, but
yeah,
was a key character in that transition in 1996.
He was a gorgeous player and a player who played bigger than his size as well. Do you know what I mean? He reckons he was 5'6" or 5'7". It's a beautiful piece, all right, because not only does it capture, if you like, the fun that great team in 96 had, and like he still plays in a band, and it just how unique he was, because the bands were bluegrass anyway. He still plays in a band called Running on Empty, and they used to have a band called Bluegrass Band called Kiss My Grass. But he says it's funny the way music resembles hurling. If you go out and you have a really good night, it's almost the same feeling as when you have a great match, you know. And then he says if you have a bad night, it's the same as a bad game of hurling. You know, you just don't click. But it's beautifully poignant. Tim, his father, who was a renowned hurler, actually died of dementia or had dementia in later years. And he was so fit and incredibly fit up until his 80s. You know, he bought him a bike for his 80s when he was working on the field. Unbelievable man. And so there's a lot in this, actually. It's a really beautiful piece because it has parts. It's loads of fun in it, loads of great reminiscences about 96. I remember, I think it was Ger Canning introduced him because he had the long hair back then as well. And he sang on the Sunday game that night. And I think Ger Canning, introduced him as the Maradona of Slaney. But there was brilliant. I mean, that team was legendary. You know, they just had so many characters. And yet Liam Griffin was able to bond them together in such a way that they were, you know, incredibly hungry, won this famous All-Ireland, but still had the fun from it. But he talks as well about the way the game has changed. And this really links in. He's a brilliant story about going up to play Ballinasloe. And again, when you think about hurling now, you know, is there still, when we look at that Limerick team of last year, is there room for the small, you know, dinky guy, the DJ Careys of the world, you know, or would they get pulled down and cynically, you know, taken it in? And he talks about this in this article, and he really, you know, doesn't like, he says, you know, people trying to get people sent off or that kind of physicality. But he does his great story about going up to Ballinasloe one day, and he was marking Joe Cooney, who, as people remember, was a monster of a man. He said, "It was snowing. I was shivering with the cold, and he had his sleeves rolled up. He went to a ball one time, and I was coming flying, and he just bent over and turned his arse, and I cracked three of my ribs off his arse." It's a brilliant image, but a really, really great piece. And it kind of, John, I thought, linked very well today with a piece that Dennis Walsh has done in the Sunday Times about cynicism in hurling and the black card and the possibility that they're finally going to, you know, do something about it. Because I think really, I was really interested to see Ned Quinn this week, you know, the long time Kilkenny chairman, the man who, you know, who would be, as Dennis says, you know, one of the GA's big hitters, because he's the outgoing chairman of the CCC, the Central Competitions Committee, and probably outside of Brian Cody, the most influential figure in Kilkenny GA. Now, Kilkenny opposed a black card motion last February, and were against the experimental rules in 2205 when they tried to bring in something again to curb cynicism and hurling. But to hear him coming out this week and to say it's time to address it, I think it's really interesting. And Dennis has a really worthy piece today, well worth reading, about, you know, he says, in front of our eyes, acts of cynicism have become accepted practice. The fouls that Declan Hannan and Will O'Donoghue committed in the All-Ireland final last December when Waterford had the scent of a goal wasn't a case of two players going rogue. They may not have been instructed to commit those fouls, but they know they had permission. They knew they had permission. If you like, it's just nothing is left to chance now. You just don't let anything to chance. And I think he quotes Liam Griffin famously, berating Ger Cush, the Wexford fullback, one time, because he bore down on an Offaly player, and he said Wexford won their first Leinster title in 19 years that day. But as Wexford manager, Griffin didn't let the incident slide. He admonished Cush within the group and made it clear in public that this kind of carry on wasn't acceptable. It was an honourable intervention that very few managers would make. And he's making the point now that hurling, now it's become a possession game. It's become a game of physicality, and so basically, you know, the ends justifies the means, and you know that it's come a time now where they just have to address that, particularly on players who look like they're going to go through for goals.
Well, there'd be penalties if this does come in. This is a GA Standing Committee on Playing Rules measure that they're proposing for a 10 minutes in bin from a black card, effectively, and then from a penalty, for an obvious goal scoring chance that's been denied. You'd hope if this does happen, it acts as a deterrent rather than something that we end up talking excessively about, like VAR.
Yeah,
because black card in football was just a nightmare at the start. Then it seemed to disappear magically out of the game. But I suppose if it's there as a deterrent to stop what we would see as players being dragged down if they're behind in a game.
I think part of the problem as well too has been, John, that the game has become so fast that like it's very hard for referees to keep up with it at this stage. But when there's something so blatant, you know, when somebody is taken down blatantly and it's really clear and obvious, you know, it's the punishment even isn't worthy of it. And he does use the phrase, and I often use it as well. It's, you know, it's almost been light touch regulation, you know, referees letting everything go, you know, but there are things now that have just become unacceptable. And the great thing about hurling for years, it was one of the reasons I love it so much, was because it was simply a question of out hurling the person that you were marking. And, you know, the army of people now who are analysing and you know, sub-analysing games to within an inch of their lives, you know, it's just about possession now and getting possession and keeping possession, and anything goes. But it feels like it's going to change. And Ned Quinn, I think it's the headline and Dennis's piece is Time for Hurling to Go Black.
Just off the field in Gaelic sports, Michael Foley has a nice piece on the appeal, you know, by Down in Cork, and saying it's indefensible. I think that's worth a read. Joe Brodie's a very comical, you know, spoof statement from Down about the circumstances that led to their ban. And Colin Maroker, I thought, was good as well. He's flicked into, you know, the weaker counties and what they need to do to help themselves, and also implore the GPA to get involved. So there's a couple of nice pieces there for, as I said, governance and areas outside the four white lines.
Yeah, Michael Foley, Cork will contest both punishments. Down will go after Paddy Talley's 12-week ban. For the ordinary toilers and water carriers of the GA, these appeals are embarrassing, infuriating, extraordinarily damaging to an organisation whose membership spent all last year doing everything to show the GA was capable of playing its game safely and responsibly. This is no time for indulging in the nuances of the GA rulebook. I think he's got a very fair and valid point.
I think it's a really good piece. Yeah. Really good piece, isn't it, John? He says the appealing these two things that are indefensible, given the fact that so many people involved in the GA, but that also, you know, everybody has been working so hard to keep the rules and to do what's right. You know, he says this was a moment when managers and counties needed to bite down and take their lashes. I'm always reminded of John Milan, famously, who you know, got a suspension one time and said, put his hands up and said, I did it. And you know, you get huge respect for that. And you know, you can try and argue for loopholes and, you know, vague rules.
stop water battery in GAA. Oh, they did that in the other county, and that goes on and all this stuff. Just take responsibility for it. And like, this is not this DRA kind of culture of, no, we're in a pandemic. He also wrote in the same page about the sponsorship deals 30 years on. The first year of sponsorship deals at GAA was 1991 in Cork. Obviously, there's the Sports Direct issue. The biggest deal in 1991, Cork's arrangement with Barry's Tea, 60,000 punts for a single year covering the hurlers and footballers.
I remember it well, John. I'm old enough to remember, actually, there was a huge debate about sponsorship coming in. I mean, it's laughable now when you think about it. But like, there was the size of the sponsorship, there was specifications in the rule book about what size the letters could be, you know, and they started getting bigger every year. There was always people getting pulled up about it. It's a really good piece. It was 1991 when it changed. And actually, the interesting thing is that Dublin ended up, I think, over the course of that year, ending up having three sponsors. They started off with Caliber, then they went to National Irish Bank, and then Arnott's took over, and that Arnott sponsorship. But it's really interesting to see the figures, because we used to always think, as journalists, we used to say, God, you know, they're probably getting them cheap, which they were, I think, at the time. The biggest deal was that Cork arranged, which was 60,000 for a single year, which covered both the footballers and the hurlers. The Arnott's one, Arnott's came in then with a 100,000, so it was 30 grand a year for 3 years. And we used to see them. But this is interesting to think about, even. Nine counties in 1991 still played without a sponsor, and they included Tyrone, Monaghan, Waterford and Cavan, you know, teams that have had great success in recent years. And it is interesting to notice that when it came to Congress that year, it did go through, but Cork's Frank Murphy was concerned about quote-unquote cheap and commercial emblazoning on jerseys, unquote. So there's a bit of an irony there, given some people's opposition, I suppose, to the sponsors that they've got this year.
I know, obviously, there's coverage and comment around MTK and Daniel Kinnan in the wake of the BBC Panorama documentary last Monday. Daniel Kinnan has no criminal convictions. In 2018, Daniel Kinnan was named in the High Court as a senior figure in organised crime on an international scale. We have pieces in The Sun. Exclusive boxing legend Baba Rum talks to The Sun. Daniel may say to us, he talked to such and such a fighter, he would like to come to the United States, but 90%, 95% of the business with MTK is with Bobby Allen, who we trust and we know is legitimate and has no bad background or anything. And also a quote from Baba Rum: if these allegations are true, what the F is he doing walking the streets? If he's guilty of anything, take the appropriate steps. If he's dabbling in boxing, it's not the fault of boxing. Also, Nicola Tallant, who was on the program the other day, about Billy Joe Saunders' advisor, Boxer's Gratitude, Fight Deal, Dan and Dusted. Saunders thanks friend Kinahan for world title bouts. And Tommy Conlon has also written about it, chronicling effectively the facts of what's gone on in this on the Independent.
Yeah, and that very interesting BBC documentary last week, really exactly is kind of summarising up all of that. You have to say the bravery of some of journalists like Nicola Tallant in the area of crime in Ireland has been immense, and she's just, you know, has led a lot of this whole debate.
Yeah, the moral vacuum, this is what Tommy writes in Prize Fighting, is almost part of its lore by now after more than 100 years of chicanery, corruption, exploitation and infestation by the criminal underworld. The fight game has long been known as the red light district of sports. It grew up on the wrong side of the tracks. It was supposed to have gone legit decades ago, but seemingly can never escape its roots. There is blood on the tracks once more. This is definitely worth reading, Tommy Conlon in the Sunday Independent. I think nothing's going to change until money becomes the issue. In other words, if boxing is a sport, comes under pressure politically or financially. For example, subscribers do not sign up to a fight because they don't like what they see in terms of the sport and the challenge to its reputation. So will I subscribe to Tyson Fury, Anthony Joshua? Have to think about that.
Yeah, I think Tommy makes a very good point, John, which is, like he's saying, it's clear that a lot of fighters are making money now that they couldn't make before, and it is a sport where it was really, really hard to make money. But his argument is at what price? I think, you know, what price? He says it's a bit fanciful to imagine Daniel Kinahan as the Robin Hood of indentured fighters. But you know, it is a sport where people, you know, have put their bodies on the line. But you know, you have to question other things. It's not just about that.
You like the piece by my good friend Mario Rosenstock in the Sunday Independent, Bernard.
Yeah, I did. I thought it was quite witty. I don't usually read him a lot, but I enjoyed it. Just around every genius is flawed, and he tells a great story about Ken Doherty. It's a sad one, but a good one. Alex Higgins was dying. He was penniless. Ken managed to convince a sponsor to let Alex play in the Irish Professional Championship to raise a few quid for his childhood hero. On the day of the first round, they arranged a bit of practice. Alex wandered in with a copy of the Racing Post and an old pouch of tobacco. It's 9 in the morning. Ken asked Alex if he wants any breakfast. No, babes, he said. His body is frail and ravaged by cancer. He's down to about 7 stone. But he said, I'd love a Guinness. And anyway, he went over. There was photographs around the table. And he recognized a familiar, handsome face in the picture on the wall. He shuffled up over, looks up and takes a sip of his pint. Pulls hard on his rolling and exhales, George Best, eh? What a waste. And just the irony of his own talent and lack of fulfillment is, you know, it really hits home. And he speaks about Christy Ring as well and Federer. So it's just a nice short piece, but I found it really interesting.
Is that a case, Bernard, that you'd identified when you were growing up as a sports person with the geniuses more so than the perfectionists?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, Maradona, you know, Jimmy White. Yeah, I definitely, Gazza. They seem to be more fascinating characters. We get some brief, I suppose, glimpses of their personality, sometimes through their mistakes. But yeah, I definitely felt they do make the game and sport more interesting. But obviously, you have to feel for the personal demons that they're going through.
Rachel Blackmore as well, profiled in the Sunday Times, Bernard.
Yeah, I just think it's brilliant. I mean, she won the Irish champion hurdle yesterday, and again, I mentioned her yesterday or earlier on. She, you know, she went over in 2015 to do a little boot camp with Mick Fitzgerald, and he was asked about his first impressions of her. He said, you know, he didn't watch her and go, wow. So she wasn't a prodigy by any manner of means. She was struggling as an amateur. She'd only won 11 points, 7 at the track, and no female rider had turned professional since the early 1980s. Not even Nina Carberry and Katie Walsh, who were obviously incredibly successful. But she took a punt and, you know, she's just turned it around. She's ridden for more. She's 615 rides that season, or last year, when no other jockey reached 500. And not just in the saddle. Apparently, she's unbelievably good with owners. She's unbelievably detailed in terms of feedback she gives trainers. And, you know, does a huge amount of work on analysing her own performance, weight training, etc., to make sure she's seen as being as strong as any man. And she's dominating the sport, and she gets no allowance. She's just the best. She's one of the best jockeys in the game. And it's just interesting. She lives with Patrick Mullins and her partner, Brian Hayes. So it's a jockey house. And he just said that Patrick Mullins said, the people you surround yourself are very important. And we've all tried living together. It's a good environment. You hate being the last one out of the house in the morning. And sometimes we don't take for granted a little bit the environment that we surround ourselves around. It's like that Man City goalkeeper. If you've got a good environment around you, you have a far greater chance of being successful.
Yeah, there was that piece about, like, Eddie O'Leary. If he's not at the races, Blackmore would text him with detailed feedback how the horses had run. He heard that she worked on weights for an hour in the evenings because she couldn't afford to be seen as weak. To be a lady rider, in O'Leary's eyes, it was a complete picture.
And the greats, all the greats, John, they do all, in sport, you know, they do all this hidden work that you never see, and you presume, oh, it's because they're talented, you know. And she's a classic example of somebody who obviously had talent, but just, you know, decided that it wasn't enough and wasn't, you know, she's obviously, where she is now means she gets the best rides as well because she's earned them, you know, but it's given her the chance to shine. I mean, I think she's a brilliant rider. If you watch her over jumps, just see how soft her hands are. Like, she's a beautiful rider. I was looking at her yesterday again, but it is incredible. But it's really interesting. Like, it kind of jumps in, I think, a bit. It reminds me a bit of the Tom Brady story in some ways, you know, as well. And obviously, this is going to be huge tonight with the Super Bowl.
Are you staying up, Cliona?
Yeah, see?
You staying up? Staying up to
I
watch
am,
us?
Definitely. Oh,
Bernard,
God,
are you
always,
staying up?
Always have.
No,
always
I won't
have.
I won't stay up, no.
Yeah, I always have. Yeah, there used to be a great tradition. The Super Bowl always coincided with the Irish Basketball Cup Finals, and obviously there were a lot of American guys who came over to play basketball in Ireland. So there was a great tradition of, we would all go. I used to cover basketball back then. We'd work on the Cup Final. You'd finish exhausted at about 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock, and then you'd go to a Super Bowl party and stay up all night afterwards. Actually, Randolph's dad, Ed Randolph. Darren Randolph's dad, who was playing basketball at the time, was a Mad Chicago fan, and so he used to lead the charge usually. But they were, I always watch it. It's unmissable, I think. And it's going to be really strange this year because you don't have the crowds, you don't have the hype. Okay, they're letting in about 25,000, isn't it? But it is a fascinating battle between two contrasting quarterbacks who are both extraordinary. And David Walsh has a nice piece. Eamon Sweeney has some great stuff today, particularly, actually, he's a lot of stuff on it. But David Walsh on Brady, just that notion, you know, that like, when he was tested, you know, in college, whatever, of 308 quarterbacks measured for speed over 40 yards, Brady was 305th fastest. Basically, they were saying I didn't look like an NFL quarterback, you know, and he was, whatever was he, wasn't he? He was drafted, whatever, 299th or 199th, I think, in the 2000 draft. And yet, what has he made of himself, you know? And it's such a contrast in style between the way that he plays in the pocket and then the way that Mahomes plays with this incredible running style, you know, it's just, and this phenomenal hand and the angles he can throw at. It's just going to be a brilliant. The one line, and Eamon Sweeney always had something interesting, and I just really liked one of his little shorts today, is on NFL kickers. I'm always fascinated by why the NFL hasn't recruited more kickers from Ireland. But he was saying that the Bucs kicker, Ryan Sukok, is on joining the league in 2019, he was dubbed Mr. Irrelevant, the traditional nickname bestowed upon the last player selected in the draft. But he was with the Titans, but he missed five of his first six field goals in 2019 before he moved. And the Chiefs guy, the Chiefs kicker, Harrison Booker, he has a bad reputation as well. And I'm always amazed at how anybody misses a kick in the NFL. I don't know, am I mad in thinking that? But it you know, compared to what we see players doing in soccer and Gaelic football, it always seems to me to be, you know, a much easier skill.
Yeah, and there's a young Irish guy, Tadhg Leader, who played for Connacht, is trying to make it over there at the moment. He's having trials with different teams. Yeah, he moved over, I think, in November. But, they all talk about the placement of the ball is the key, but, in fairness, they have a very high success rate general. But if you miss one or two, that could be the end of your career.
Yeah.
Yeah, David Walsh, if the aim is to play into your 40s, look is important too, considering that the young Brady did not look like a typical NFL quarterback. He turned out to be a physical freak. There was one knee construction in 2008, which cost him a season. Beyond that, no injury worth mentioning through the 12 seasons that followed knee surgery. He didn't miss one game through injury. This is not all down to drawing the right ticket in the DNA lottery. In 2004, he began working with trainer Alex Guerrero, moving away from weights and getting into bands, ropes and exercise balls. He concentrated on nutrition and hydration, made muscle pliancy rather than flexibility the goal. He believes there is considerable difference between pliancy and flexibility.
And Mahomes, isn't it, is you know, and there is often this element of being like, he had a dislocated kneecap, was it last season? And he was back, I think, within 2 or 3 weeks. Eamon Sweeney is very good on him today as well, you know. So, like, sometimes you have gifts, you know, but that doesn't mean you will succeed if you don't have the dedication, you know, to use it. And probably mental strength as well, which is what Brady has shown incredibly, particularly after coming back from, you know, being so bad last year.
We pretty much run out of time, Bernard. Anything else that we should note maybe just when we go offline?
No, I like that piece on McDermott Crowe on
Sean Flood. I haven't read that yet, but
that's my article of the week.
You summed it up perfectly. You summed it up perfectly, and also I think it's also we should be maybe doing more of these pieces with these GA legends and role models and in their communities and still have hero status. Cliona, anything that we don't have time for that you should maybe point out?
Yeah, just Philip Lanigan in Mail on Sunday with Fergal McGill from the GAA talking about how they've handled the whole COVID. And he's saying very strongly that they believe they will get the National Leagues played. No great detail in it, but well worth a read.
And transformative as well, the club and the county split that they're going to have in the GAA. Bernard Jackman and Cliona Foley, enjoy Ireland against Wales this afternoon. And thanks so much for giving your insight on today's Sunday paper review.
Brilliant. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, off the ball on your radio from 1 until 7 on News Talk and on the OTB Sports app. We've got two live and exclusive Premier League commentary games to bring you. Nathan Murphy and Damien Delaney will call the shots for one of the biggest matches in global football as champions Liverpool play Manchester City at Anfield. We'll also showcase the game involving Wolves and Leicester City with Stephen Doyle and Brian Kerr in the commentary box for that one. And Johnny Murphy will keep us up to date on the Six Nations encounter between Ireland and Wales. If you missed any of the Sunday paper review we've just had on there, you can check out the podcast on the OTB Sports app or wherever you get your pods. You can also watch it back on YouTube on the Off the Ball channel. We're back on your radio from 1.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.